On this episode of the All-American Legacy Podcast.
One paratrooper fell right in the middle of the fire and exploded with his ammunition.
Virtually no terrain in the world is better suited for defensive action than the hedgerows our paratroopers found in St. Mary-Glise.
And they would have killed everybody. So probably I wouldn't have the pleasure of talking with you today.
This is the 82nd Airborne Division, fearless among fighting units.
From Fort Bragg, home of the airborne and the center of the military universe, this is the All-American Legacy Podcast.
No! No!
An inside look at the 100-year history of the 82nd.
They are All-American all the way.
Welcome back to the All-American Legacy Podcast. This is Joe Bacino. This is episode 14, The Day Before the Day, Part 2. This is part 2 of a two-part series on the 82nd Airborne Division on D-Day. If you've not heard episode 13, please stop, go back, and listen to that one first. In that episode, we left off with General Gavin in England telling the paratroopers of the 82nd Airborne Division about their D-Day mission. General Gavin told his men that the 82nd Airborne Division was to jump into the French town of St. Mary-Glise in Normandy on the night of June 5, 1944, to secure the area for the June 6th beachhead landings. Today, we're hosted once again by Doug Ray. Let's start the show.
In last week's episode, The Day Before the Day, Part 1, we brought you Acts 1 and 2. We took you to England, where the 82nd Airborne Division prepared for D-Day and brought you the man who led them on that mission. Today, we bring you the stories of the men who jumped into Normandy. The mission for the 82nd Airborne Division was in the town of St. Mary-Glise. In this episode, we'll learn that when our men got there on the night of June 5th, 1944, they would have to contend not only with German forces, but they also had to fight through impenetrable mounds of earth called hedgerows that challenged offensive operations. Act 3, The Church of the Holy Mother of God. More than 2,400 years ago, Sun Tzu advised military planners to base their attacks around the use of high ground. Since then, so much of human conflict has been defined by terrain. Open fields favor a defense. Forestry favors an offense. As historian David Zabecki tells us, topography is destiny. So too for our paratroopers in St. Mary-Glise. The town is named after the Church of the Holy Mother of God. It was an unholy place for the All-Americans on the night of June 5th. Maurice Renault was 2 years old on June 5th, 1944. His father, Alexander Renault, was the mayor of St. Mary-Glise. All his life, Maurice's father and older brother, Henri Jean, who was 10 in 1944, regaled him with their memories of that night. Here is his story.
Around 10 o'clock, somebody came to my father's pharmacy, knocked on the door, and said, "Well, Mayor, there is a fire on the other side of the square, actually where the Airborne Museum is now, and we need to go." So the alarm bell was ringing, and so he went with the firemen, and they were there. And about half an hour later, planes were coming to fly over the town, and the Germans got out of the commandant tour, which was only like 200 yards from the fire, and they were about three or four dozens of Germans around and with their guns, and so they were watching the men working on the fire. And then suddenly the paratroopers appeared, and everybody did not know what to do. Now they were falling all over the place. And one paratrooper fell right in the middle of the fire and exploded with his ammunition. Another one, and my father was like 30 meters from him. Another one fell in a tree, and he was about 20 yards from a German soldier, and he was trying to get down. He probably lost his machine gun. He was trying to go down the tree very quietly, but at one point the Germans saw him and he shot him right there. I must say that the Germans were absolutely horrible, because they killed every paratrooper who fell in the tree. There were some big trees, at that time on the square of Sainte Marie Église, some very high trees, and they killed about 7 or 8 paratroopers in the trees. They did not take any prisoners. The only prisoner they took was John Steele. Now, John Steele fell on the steeple that you see in The Longest Day. And the Germans who were, there were actually 3 Germans in the steeple, were artillery observers. They have been posted there since several days. And they did not shoot him because they thought, number one, that he was dead. But when they saw that he was still moving, they took him down because they were afraid to shoot him because the other paratroopers around would have noticed the fact that they were in the steeple. So that was a tragic thing which happened on the square. And then when it happened, my father told everybody, you go home because now it's the invasion and you got to go home, forget about the fire. Everybody went home. All the Germans took off and left Sainte-Marie-Église, and they went south about 2 miles, even 1 mile south of Sainte-Marie-Église. They just deserted the commandant tour and everything. My father was a World War I veteran, so he was not that impressed with the battle because he had been in Verdun, he had been in Ypres, he had been in Chemin des Dames, which were all terrible places. He was a lieutenant with a machine gun platoon, and so he left. We had the part of the house on the back of the road which goes to the sea, so he walked back and we had a piece of land there. He was watching to see what was going on. When he was there, there was a little pond. One paratrooper fell right in the water. And you know, these guys, they had like 60 pounds of equipment. The water was maybe 5-6 feet high, and there was a lot of mud, and he was drowning. So my father pulled him out, and you know, the paratrooper got scared because he did not know if the guy who was pulling him out was in at night. There was no light at all. Was a German or was, a French who was with the Germans, whatever. Anyway, my father told him, don't worry, I'm French and you're okay. So he pulled him out and the guy said, thank you. And took off his shoes and he disappeared. We never heard of him again. Now, Sainte-Marie-Église was like, you know, the Fort Alamo in San Antonio. With the Mexicans around. Well, here it was exactly the same situation. We had the small town, which was liberated, and there were about 350 American paratroopers, mainly 82nd, but some guys also from the 101st, but mainly 82nd and mainly 505 and 507, I guess. So these guys, they had a very light equipment. I think they had 2 or 3 machine guns, can you believe it? They had few bazookas, and you know, the American bazookas at that time were not very powerful. So they didn't have a resupply of ammunition. On top of it, they had absolutely zero communication with the troops coming on shore, which was 6 miles away. And so they did not know what was going on. So you had these 360 guys plus the civilians in the town surrounded by thousands of Germans. So Germans to the north, a big regiment of German with artillery and tanks. Germans to the west, which is a famous La Fière battleground, which is one of the worst little battles of World War II in Europe. And they had on the other side of the marshes, you had a regiment of tanks. South, you had also, there was a flak regiment. And on the east, there was a company or 2 companies of Georgian guys from Georgia were fighting with the Germans. So at one point, after 24 hours, realizing that Sainte-Marie-Église had been liberated, they started shelling Sainte-Marie-Église. And of course, the guys who were in the steeple could give indication by radio to the artillery, which was like 5 miles away. They had these terrible, dreadful 88 guns, which they started to shell on the town. And then they also started to counterattack on the north, and there were 2 tanks which were stopped, like at the edge of the town, just on top of the hill, and by guys with bazookas. And also in La Fierre, same story. They were Marcus Heim. I think he was also a 505 guy, and I knew him. I met him several times too. He, with a bazooka, he knocked down two tanks, two German tanks, and he blocked the entrance of the bridge so they could not come through. And if these tanks had been able to move in from the west or from the north, well, I tell you, Sainte-Marguerite would have been totally set afire, because they did that in other places in France, and they would have killed everybody. So probably I wouldn't have the pleasure of talking with you today.
Historian Paul Woodage has been living the terrain of the 82nd Airborne Division's airborne assault in Normandy for more than 20 years. He gives battlefield tours of the area and studies the area day in and day out. He spoke with us about what our paratroopers found on the ground. Virtually no terrain in the world is better suited for defensive action than the hedgerows our paratroopers found in Sainte-Marguerite. Paul spoke with us about how terrain favored the Germans.
So hedgerows provide an environment that was very difficult for any type of set-piece maneuvers. You can't see anything. You can't see the battlefield around you. So whether you're an Allied soldier or a German soldier, you will have trained in the typical type of open-air training grounds that the 82nd trainers go, you know, where the commanders can stand on a hilltop and see the battle over there, and what's the APCs moving left and their troops moving right. And that's how men have trained for war for centuries. And that is exactly the type of environment you don't have in Normandy. There are huge areas I take people to on my tours where you can't see more than about 200 yards any direction, because everywhere you look, there's a hedgerow blocking the view. So, you know, you're a platoon commander or a sergeant there, you don't know what's around the next corner. You can't see, you can't elevate yourself to see anything. And the maps they have are at best basic, and they don't provide the terrain information a soldier today would have. So the only the way of fighting through these things was, well, I call it sheer goddamn persistence, really. Just accepting the fact you're going to lose a number of your own men to take every mile you push. And really a war of attrition. We have, and always have, more troops than the Germans have. And every inch we gain, we've gained. The Germans can't take it back again. So it's just a slow, slogging, trudging campaign. So Allied commanders were completely aware of exactly the type of terrain they were going to face. That said, though, your average Joe from Delaware, who's a private in the 505th, had no idea what he was going to face, because that information couldn't be filtered down to the people who actually needed to know it. It had to be kept at a high level because of the security. If you start briefing every member of the 505th a month before D-Day on the terrain they're going to encounter in Normandy, and then they start chatting in the pub on next furlough or something, there's always a chance that information that we're going to Normandy can leak. And we have, of course, to invade on June the 6th with the Germans not knowing it's going to be Normandy. So I always get a little annoyed when I see these documentaries that say we didn't know about the hedgerows. We did, but you have it true.
What Paul is referring to is the myth, perpetuated by some historians, that the Allies did not know about the hedgerows in Normandy when they planned the D-Day assault.
They didn't know about the hedgerows, neither did their platoon commanders, probably their town commander didn't know. Did the regimental commanders know? Probably yes. Did the command structure around somewhere, General Gavin, know? Yes, they probably did know. It's just that information couldn't be given to the men prior to the invasion. They're far better spending their time teaching them about Hawkins mines and parachute harness release systems, all that type of thing, that is the stuff that they've been training on and with for months. That's what you keep on training. Don't give away geographic information simply because it could then be released to the enemy.
Sainte-Marguerite was the first town liberated on D-Day. In fact, by the time the Allied ships reached the Normandy beaches, the American flag was flying in Sainte-Mare. Ed Ruggiero, historian and author of many books on the 82nd and World War II, explains.
Lieutenant Colonel Ed Krause was the commander of 3rd Battalion of the 505, and before his men left England, he showed them a large American flag, a 48-star flag, that he said he was going to hang in the village of Sainte-Marguerite. 3rd Battalion had probably the best drop of the division, with large number of their men able to consolidate on the drop zone and move very quickly into San Maraglia. Krauss put out blocking positions on the major roads that led in and out of town, and then with the help of local French civilians, started rousting German soldiers, who incredibly had been alerted when a stick of the 101st troopers were dropped, but then went back to bed. The Germans knew that there were paratroopers. Maybe they thought it was a raid. They went back to bed, which led to many of them being captured or killed, the ones who couldn't escape town. So before the sun comes up on D-Day, 3rd Battalion at least has blocking positions out in town and then starts scouring the town to see who else might be behind. And when in the morning of D-Day, when the sun is up, Krauss goes to what had been the town hall, which is on the road leading just north out of San Maraglia. The Germans were using it as their local headquarters, and Krauss climbs up. When you go in the building, it has these beautiful sweeping staircases. Goes up to the second floor and leans out the window and raises on a flagpole that's on the front of the building, comes out of the front of the building, he raises this American flag. And of course, San Maraglia is famous as the first town liberated by the Allies in the invasion. Krauss's widow, after the war, would donate that flag to the town. And if you go to the city hall there in San Maraglia, you can see this flag displayed at the top of this staircase that Krauss had climbed to raise it.
Act 4, The Men. So we've heard the mission. We've told you about the leader. You know the place. Now we need to share the most important part of our D-Day history, the stories of the paratroopers who participated in it.
And the pilot we had got off course and dumped us 10 miles from the designated area in a field. And luckily the field was in with some farmers there that were real friendly people. And they guided us back to get back behind the lines where we could get back and see what was going on. But it was a scary situation when you get dumped somewhere where you don't know when in the world you're at.
We were at the bridge. They were coming around the curve. Everybody had got the message, pick one out. I picked one out and got a sight, hand on the trigger, and pulled it. I could see when the bullet hit him. He jumped up in the air, raised his arms above his head, and dropped his rifle and fell backwards.
And all the way through Normandy, I landed about 20 minutes after 1 midnight on June the 6th, one of the first ones on the ground, really. And I went all the way through Normandy from June the 6th to the 13th of July, but I didn't get wounded. But of the 12,000 airborne, there's only 3,200 of us got out.
Here again is Ed Ruggiero on the story of Bob Murphy, 505th Parachute Infantry Regiment.
One of the other soldiers I got to know, former paratroopers, was 18 years old when he jumped into Normandy. Bob Murphy was with A Company of the 505. This was not his first combat action. He had actually lied about his age to join the Army, so he was a very young paratrooper. Selected as a pathfinder, he trained in Sicily, and they executed that mission, the pathfinder's mission, in Italy. Murphy got caught up in his chute and had to use his boot knife to cut loose. He also managed to cut loose his ammunition, so he had to go around during the night, the early morning hours of D-Day, and beg for ammunition. But he was part of a group that was assigned to seize the causeway at a place called La Fierre, one of the critical crossings of the Murderay River in the flooded area that division headquarters had identified as a possible route what the Germans would use to a counterattack against the rear of Utah Beach. So this was a critical river crossing. When the paratroopers of A Company of the 505 approach it in the early morning hours of D-Day, they recognize that it's been turned into a strong point. There's a substantial stone manor house there with a tower that gave the defenders, the Germans defending, good vision of what was going on. The whole area is cut through with very thick hedgerows, which make the fields small. The hedgerows are almost impenetrable. And the 1st Battalion of the 505 suffers significant casualties as they make this assault. The battalion commander, the battalion executive officer, and S3, and three platoon leaders from A Company are all killed in those hours on D-Day as the paratroopers are resisting the first German assaults. But what's interesting to me about Bob Murphy is, here's a young man who in the course of memorizing what the mission was supposed to look like, he also had absorbed what in the modern military we would call the commander's intent, a very simple statement of what they were trying to achieve, and that's that no Germans get across that bridge. So as Bob Murphy and the sun comes up on D+1 after having withstood first German counterattacks on D-Day, Bob Murphy recognizes that although there was supposed to be a rifle company to his right and a rifle company to his left and another battalion of paratroopers on the far side, that is the enemy side of the causeway at La Fierre, none of those other forces had managed to arrive. So you have about 80 troopers from A Company of the 505 who are in position above the causeway at La Fierre. But the commander's intent remains the same. And so Bob Murphy, as he lays out his ammunition and hand grenades and wonders if he's going to have enough, knows that whatever else happens, you can't let any Germans get across that bridge. The A Company commander, John Dolan, was able to consolidate and reorganize his defensive position. But when one goes to Normandy today and stands on a small hill overlooking La Fierre Causeway and that little stone bridge, there's a statue of an Iron Mike, a paratrooper, standing there looking out with inscriptions in both French and English that recognizes that this was a critical action that took place there. And really, it was the tenacity of those paratroopers who refused to give up on their mission, even though clearly the plan had fallen apart. And as Bob Murphy would point out, he said, well, it's important to have memoirs written by senior officers who have their maps and have an understanding of the strategy that was being used, that really, finally, it's the privates who are the ones who are firing the rifles and the bazookas and throwing the hand grenades and refusing to be pushed out of their foxholes who make the difference. And it's important to keep that in mind, and also to keep in mind for the leaders that those privates have to understand what the mission is and have to buy into it as much as any man in the chain of command.
Over the past 100 years, there have been events that demonstrate the 82nd Airborne Division's values and spirit. D-Day is a day that defines who we are and what we represent to the world. Our D-Day paratroopers hover around us. Their names live in our streets. Their images hang on our walls. But we must never become lost in their symbols. We must always remember their stories. We must always live on in their tradition. For we are America's Guard of Honor.
On the next episode of the All American Legacy Podcast.
It didn't matter where you were on that beach, they could see you and shoot at you and everything else. I ended up basically on what they call the Mussolini Canal.
People that are together in their adversity develop a certain bond. But obviously in combat, it's a relationship unlike any other. It's not a natural relationship.
Our job was to block off the crossroads and set up roadblocks, put the landmines where we could keep the tanks from getting to the coast, to save the guys, to help the guys that were landing at Utah Beach and Omaha Beach.
And if you're with them, with the unit and with the guys that you're fighting with any length of time, you get to know them, you develop a very strong bond that carries on actually eternity to this day.
So it was hectic. I jumped out of the plane with the idea I was going to be the radio operator. No, the equipment wasn't there, so I ended up being just a regular soldier. Eventually, on the second day, we started to regroup, and then they brought in the radar equipment, and that tool was damaged. Back home, they always refer to me as a hero. I'm no hero. And I always keep saying that the heroes are buried here. Those are the heroes.